Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum is what we do generally on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and we're very happy to have you here with us. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and you are welcome to call if you have any question of a religious nature, particularly if you have questions about the Catholic Church, Catholic faith, Catholic people. Whether or not you're Catholic, your call is very welcome here, 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Our guest this hour is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Hi, Jimmy. How are you?
Hey, how you doing, Cy?
I am doing really well. I feel like it almost feels like deja vu because we were just here doing this together.
Yesterday.
One day ago. Yeah. We got a question In the emails. I don't know where I was going with that,
over the tubes in the interwebs.
Yeah, right. Somehow it found its way through the tubes in the interwebs. It's from a man named Carl. Mm-hmm. I believe you shared it with me, so it must have come to you.
It came to Darren, and he forwarded it to both of us.
Oh, got it. Okay, so. And this is what Carl would like to know.
Okay.
All of the Passion narratives seem to agree that the Jews were unable to sentence anyone to death, so they wanted Pilate to do it. Mm-hmm. Yet, very soon after the crucifixion, we see Stephen being stoned to death by presumably many of those same people. What changed, if anything, in the interim?
Okay, so this is a question that has a very interesting answer. Now, it's not just the Gospels that indicate that the Jewish authorities didn't have the ability to inflict capital punishment, that they had to go to the Roman procurator for that. Josephus, the Jewish historian, later on in the first century indicates the same thing. And he tells a very interesting story about what happened in the year AD 62. Now, you may remember at one point this is later in the book of Acts, Paul is in Jerusalem and a riot starts and he gets arrested and taken to the governor's palace up in Caesarea Maritima, which is on the seacoast, which is why it's called Maritima. And while he's there, at first, the governor is a guy named Felix. Felix likes listening to Paul. He's also hoping Paul's going to give him a bribe. But mm-hmm. Paul doesn't, and so he keeps him in jail for 2 years. And then he's replaced by a new governor named Festus. And Festus is a very efficient and honest governor, and he deals with Paul's case expeditiously, doesn't leave him languishing in jail anymore, and ends up, when Paul invokes his right to have his case heard by Caesar, who at this time would have been Nero, he says, okay, you've appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you will go. And they ship Paul off to Rome for his first Roman imprisonment. Now, Festus continued to govern in Judea for a few years. But in AD 62, he died. And so Caesar, Nero, then sent a replacement governor named Albinus. But it took Albinus a while to get there. And that meant while we have this interregnum between Festus and Albinus, the Jewish authorities are the highest authorities there. And the high priest at the time was a guy named Ananus ben Ananus.
Oh.
And so he's like Ananus Jr.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he decided, hey, now that there's no governor for the moment, I can throw my weight around. And one of the things I want to do is get rid of that annoying person, James the Just, the brother of Jesus.
Okay.
And so he ended up executing James the Just, the brother of Jesus. But in doing so, he usurped an authority that the Romans had reserved to themselves, namely capital punishment. And so while Albinus was still on the road, the Jews sent delegates to him and said, hey, you need to be aware of what's happening with the high priest. He's killing people.
Yeah.
And so when Albinus gets there, he deposes Ananus from the high priesthood. So this is an illustration of how the Romans did reserve the death penalty to themselves, but during these interregnum periods, the Jewish authorities might seize the initiative to do stuff on their own.
I see.
And so let's look back to the time of Jesus. Well, in AD 33, the most probable year for the crucifixion, the governor was Pontius Pilate. He served from AD 26 to AD 36, so like 10 years. And so during that period, the Jewish authorities needed to go to him to have Jesus executed. But then towards the end of the reign of Tiberius, Pilate gets recalled to Rome for mismanagement. He had massacred a bunch of Samaritans, and that generated complaints, and he gets recalled to Rome. And it takes a while for his new replacement, Marcellus, to get there. And the best explanation for the execution of Stephen and the ongoing executions that were then overseen in part by St. Paul is that they occurred in the interregnum between Pilate and Marcellus in the year AD 36. So you can date the events of Acts chapters 7 through 9. 7 is Stephen's speech before the Sanhedrin. He then gets executed in chapter 8. Paul is continuing executions in chapter 9. You can date the events of Acts 7 to 9 to the year AD 36. So very interesting question, bringing up a bit of biblical chronology.
Yeah.
Incidentally, one thing, you could argue that Stephen was just a lynching. So it was an extra – because he's given this speech. People get enraged.
Like the woman caught in adultery would have
been. Yeah, they'd drag him out and stone him. Yeah, exactly. So although you could use lynching as, say, this is an extrajudicial one, you can't say that for Paul's because he has letters from the high priest authorizing him to do this.
Yeah, right. And does and Stephen, just by the fact that he appeared before the Sanhedrin, wouldn't that make –
Well, you could also nail him for that too. I mean, if you're the Roman governor, it's like, hey, look at what you guys did in your official Hall of Justice.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it was called a Hall of Justice?
Actually, it was called the Hall of Hewn Stones, but it's where they administered justice.
Oh. Because wasn't there a later Hall of Justice?
Yeah, that came some around? Real super friends hung out there.
Carl, thanks so much for that question. Carl sent it, and he wasn't sure if it was one that we should save for the Weird Questions show.
It wasn't weird, just interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why we got to it today, Carl. But if you ever have a weird question that you want to ask Jimmy Akin, send it to radio@catholic.com, and we'll do our very best to take care of it on the Weird Question Friday when we get to it. 888-318-7884 is our number, and we go now to Scott in Iowa, listening on 106.1 FM. Scott, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yeah, so my question, I was listening to your guys' show a little while ago, maybe a week or two, and I heard a pretty good attack you guys had on substitutionary atonement, which I when I say attack, I don't mean anything.
You mean critique.
You know, that's what I mean. And so
– And not substitutionary atonement, but penal substitution.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yes. I think that's the technical term. And so I wanted to hear more about vicarious merit, just because I think you guys had to kind of move on to the next one. And so it wasn't a very thorough explanation of vicarious merit. And so I did some reading into it, but I don't seem to be quite following exactly how vicarious merit is supposed to work. From my understanding, Jesus's sacrifice on the cross was such a good thing that God forgave everyone's sins. But yet, I'm still not quite following what was so great about it. If he wasn't actually dying in place of another or something, or I didn't quite follow it.
Okay.
So first of all, I think it's important that we clarify our terminology because it's easy to get things mixed up if we're if we're loose about that. The idea of that you've probably heard critiqued on the show is called penal substitution. And the idea of penal substitution is that God punished Christ as our substitute. So Christ substituted for us on the cross, and that's certainly true. He did serve, he did go to the cross on our behalf in order to accomplish something for us. But the question is, did God literally punish him there? And that's where the word penal comes in. Penal has to do with punishment. It's from the Latin word for punishment. And so in some areas of the Christian world, you will have people saying God literally punished Jesus in our behalf, in our stead. And that's a problem because Jesus is not only infinite, he's not only innocent, he's also infinitely holy. And it would make no sense for a just God to literally punish an infinitely good person. So that idea doesn't make any sense. Now, you might be able to poetically say he took our punishment or something like that, but you wouldn't mean it literally. And so that's the idea that was being critiqued. So whatever Jesus was doing for us on the cross, and there are many different converging and compatible explanations of exactly how the atonement worked. We don't have to view them exclusively as, you know, canceling each other out. But in what Jesus did on the cross, he did something on our behalf, and it satisfied God's justice and became an occasion of mercy whereby God is willing to forgive our sins because of what Jesus did. And you can conceptualize that different ways. Sometimes the term not penal substitution, but vicarious satisfaction, which just means vicarious means substitutionary, and satisfaction means Jesus satisfied God's requirements so that we could be saved. Vicarious satisfaction is an acceptable way to characterize what Jesus did on the cross because it doesn't involve God literally punishing Jesus. Now, in terms of the term you mentioned, vicarious merit, I'm not aware of any Catholic authors who use this term. I can figure out what it means based on the two terms that are involved. Vicarious means substitutionary or on behalf of another, and merit refers to something that pleases God and that he rewards. And so you could say, well, Jesus obviously merited our salvation on the cross. You know, he did something that was so good for us that God is willing to forgive our sins and bring us to heaven to be with him. So he merited our salvation. And he did that in a vicarious way, namely on our behalf. So you could talk about vicarious merit in that sense, but it's not an established term. A more established term is vicarious satisfaction. You will find Catholics using that, not just for Jesus, but in other instances as well. Obviously, Jesus's satisfaction being the most important. And the idea there would be basically that on our behalf or vicariously, Jesus did something that satisfied the demands of God's justice so that we could be saved.
Scott, we'll have to leave it there. I hope that that was helpful to you, but we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Summer is upon us, and though the temperatures are going up, the prices are coming down during Catholic Answers' first ever summer book sale in the online shop at Catholic.com. For a limited time, dozens of great books are available for $10, $5, even as low as $1 a copy. This is the time to load up on solid Catholic books for you, your friends, and your family. The spectacular online event offers savings of 50% and more on books by Jimmy Akin, Tim Staples, Rod Bennett, Gary Machuda, and a whole host of esteemed authors, evangelists, and apologists. We've even got all of the books in our Catholic Answers Classics series marked down. Log on now to shop.catholic.com and take advantage of what will be one of the most exciting sales of the summer. You know it's all good stuff because it's from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers. Log on to shop.catholic.com and start saving today.
This is Tim Staples, and I'm really excited to tell you about a special limited-time offer we've got right now on subscriptions to our award-winning Catholic Answers magazine. Sign up today during our annual subscription drive, and not only can you save big bucks off the normal price, we'll give you a digital subscription to the magazine for free. Subscribe today by calling 818-487-2011 or logging online to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. Sign up for a one-year subscription and we'll give you $10 off the normal price. Better yet, become a two-year subscriber and we'll up the ante by dropping the price $20. That's a saving of $10 to $20 plus a free digital subscription when you sign up for a subscription to Catholic Answers Magazine. Act now. This is our best offer of the year, and it's only available for a limited time. Subscribe to Catholic Answers Magazine before our annual subscription drive ends. Phone 818-487-2011 or go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com today.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest this hour. It's open forum. If you've got a question about the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, that is very welcome. 888-318-7884 is the number. I'm going to name some stuff here, see if you can find the common thread. Drama of salvation, understanding revelation, why you can trust the Gospels. Do you see a common thread to any of those?
They're all about religion.
I think they're all titles of works from you.
Yeah, well, that's
did you
true.
Forget that? Oh, okay. You were being modest. All those works by Jimmy, and then many more things by Tim Staples, Gary Machuda, Matt Frad, and others are available at shop.catholic.com for either $1, $5, or $10 per book or DVD. And then you get a $5 flat rate on shipping within the continental United States. To take advantage of that, that's the June special. You just go to shop.catholic.com and you can get all that stuff at very, very low prices. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. We go now to Tyler in Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Ave Maria Radio coming through for us today. Tyler, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Jimmy. Si, thank you for having me. A few of my family members have been reading this book called The Convoluted Universe, and it's about a psychoanalyst who puts people in like a trance and speaks and listens to the subconscious. It kind of brought up a red flag when that was talked about between them and myself, but I wasn't really sure what the Catholic teaching is on it. It kind of doesn't sound very right, and I just wasn't really sure where to go with that conversation. I tried just explaining, it talks about the soul and reincarnation of the soul. I tried explaining a few teachings on that, but I wasn't really sure where to go with the whole psychoanalysis thing.
Oh, okay.
So is this book fiction or nonfiction?
No, it's a fiction book.
The
writer is a psychoanalyst. I believe she puts people in trance and then like records and then listens to the subconscious speak. It's really strange. But there's another book called Seth Speaks, similar in nature.
Wait, Seth Speaks? Did you?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a whole different kettle of fish. Let's deal with the question as phrased first. The church doesn't have a particular teaching on psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is a discipline that developed in psychology fairly early on after the psychology movement really got rolling in the late 19th and early 20th century. Psychoanalysis in particular stems from the Freudian tradition where he would basically lay you down, let you relax, and then talk to you about your problems and what was distressing you. And he would then try to figure out what the root causes of them were, typically based on events earlier in your life, especially in childhood. And he also had an idea about the subconscious that attributed ideas to the subconscious and abilities to the subconscious that have largely been discredited. And that's true of Freudian analysis in general. Freud's theories of psychology today are looked upon broadly, although there are still Freudians, but they're looked upon broadly as early kind of fumbling steps in psychology, kind of like we would look at the science of the Middle Ages. You know, they got some stuff right. They were trying to do something legitimate, but they hadn't worked out a lot of the basics yet, and they made mistakes. And Freud's thought and that of other early psychiatrists is viewed similarly. So although the church doesn't have a teaching on this, a lot of particularly Freudian ideas have been discredited in the psychological community. Now, that doesn't mean that talking about your problems and trying to analyze them and figure them out and that kind of what was then called a talking cure, that's invalid. That's a technique that's used today, and it helps various people. So there's nothing in principle wrong with talking about your problems and trying to figure them out. People have done that all throughout history. In terms of putting people into a trance, this is another thing that's hypnosis. The church doesn't have a teaching on hypnosis. It to the extent that it's a real phenomenon, that where someone really enters an unusual state of mind that allows them to perhaps deal with various emotional issues they have or quit smoking or lose weight or whatever it may be, it's legitimate to the extent that it has valid effects. Now, there are some sharp limits here. One of them is the effects of hypnosis on memory. These have frequently been oversold, and this is not a matter of faith right now that I'm speaking to. It's a matter of science. Hypnosis does not enable you to remember events in fantastic detail that you had forgotten and dredge them up from your subconscious. Instead, it can promote what's known as confabulation or making stuff up unintentionally. And back in the 1980s and 1990s, a lot of people's lives were totally ruined in court cases where hypnosis was used to allegedly uncover events of childhood sexual abuse that never in fact occurred, but people got accused of it because hypnotists were using this as a technique to try to recover memories, and really what was happening was people's imaginations were just being let loose. And when subsequent studies tried to follow up and say, well, how could this have happened? Was this person really in a place to abuse this person at this time? It would turn out the answer was no. It was just confabulation. Personally, and I'm just speaking for myself here, I'm skeptical of hypnosis in general. I don't think it's really a thing. I don't think it really puts you in an altered state of consciousness. I think what happens is you relax, but you're still in your right mind, and you know, based on movies and TV shows and books, how a hypnotized person is supposed to act. And so you assume that role and you're acting out this role. But it doesn't put you in some really weird, freaky state of mind. You're just acting a role you've seen and relaxing. And to the extent that it helps you with various things like weight loss or stopping smoking, that's just the placebo effect. You're just talking yourself into being confident that, hey, I'm going to lose weight, or hey, I'm going to stop smoking. So I personally am quite skeptical of hypnosis. Now, in terms of – as anything other than a placebo and a social role, I should say. In terms of Seth Speaks, okay, that's a book by, if memory serves, Jane Roberts, or at least in it was written in connection with Jane Roberts, who back – several decades ago, like in the 1970s, was basically what we today would call a trans-channeler or a medium. And she claimed that by going into a trance, she could be put in contact with a spirit called Seth. And Seth would then reveal to her various things. And it did into the Seth books, and there was more than one, but the Seth books did indeed go into reincarnation and stuff like that. And they were not presented as fiction. They were presented as this is really happening. And so you would find them, for example, in the New Age section of a bookstore. And they're definitely incompatible with the Christian faith, in particular with regard to their teachings of reincarnation and this activity of talking to a dead spirit and summoning one up, I mean, that's necromancy, where you're summoning up dead spirits to try to get information out of them. And so there is indeed a cause for concern there. If you'd like to read a church document that deals with these general subjects, it doesn't deal with Seth Speaks specifically, but the Pontifical Council for Culture a few years ago came out with a document called Bearer of Living Water, which dealt with various aspects of the New Age movement. And so if you actually, the full title is Jesus Christ, Bearer of Living Water. And so if you just search for that online, it should come right up.
Tyler, thanks very, very much for the call. I hope that that was helpful to you. I never had a view on hypnotism. I'm interested mm-hmm. to hear your view about it, because I've never been hypnotized. I've never even thought I was hypnotized. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those things where you hear that about that sometimes too, that people think that therapy is supposed to go a certain way because they've seen it on TV or something. So they go into therapy and they act like a patient,
yeah,
because they know that that's how they're supposed to act.
Yeah.
But that's how I do radio. I act
like a host.
I act like a radio host.
You know
I just
what they say,
I
fake it till you make it.
Yeah. One of these days I'm going to make it, Jimmy. One of these days. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Open Forum is our topic, meaning if you've got a question, we'll try to get you an answer. We really welcome non-Catholic callers, so you're welcome to call if you are not Catholic. We also welcome Catholic callers on Open Forum days. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Sharing the gospel with family and friends can be challenging. It's especially hard when they won't even hear you out because of all the mental roadblocks they've built up. This is Carlo Broussard, and in my new book, Prepare the Way, my aim is to help you tackle that essential first step to apologetics and evangelization, getting people to listen with an open mind. Even our best witness can bounce right off folks like these if we don't prepare the way first, breaking down barriers and leaving minds and souls free to encounter the truth. I'll give you evidence and arguments and step-by-step strategies based on asking the right questions to help them overcome their obstacles and make a straight path for the Lord. Order your copy of Prepare the Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. We all hear sayings like these, and we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers. Nobody can seem to place their origin, but by sheer repetition, they've acquired a halo of truth. In my new book, What the Saints Never Said, I look at over 40 of these well-known sayings and track them back to their original sources. You'll be surprised at what I found. Some are close to what was really said. Many were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few of these sayings were simply made up. I hope by setting the record straight, I can make you aware of the theological errors that can lead us away from the faith and offer you authentic quotes from Scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to our faith. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I have wanted to thank you so very much. Thank God. Thank God you guys are here for us. Believe it. I just can't believe all that you've done and how you've stuck with it. Many times when I think I can't do something, I think about some of the things that you've talked about.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
That is some rockin' groovy music right there, and Jimmy Akin's here to share it with us. What a great way to spend a Thursday afternoon.
Which is good, because I have an earworm that I'm fighting right now.
Oh, somebody told me that if you sing the theme to Gilligan's Island, it gets those earworms out.
At the price of replacing them with another.
Yeah, now you're stuck with just sit right back.
And what's this and the rest stuff? Come on.
Sometimes it's and the rest.
Yeah, that's first season.
Oh, so and first season is
later
and the rest.
Later they changed it to Professor and Marianne. It's like, come on.
You had two more people.
Couldn't you have done that in the beginning?
Yeah, right.
And they're like two of the best characters, too. I mean, Marianne or Ginger? Come on.
I know. Every man knows the answer to that. And the Professor Man with his cool deck
way more
deck
fun
shoes.
Than Mr. Howell.
Yeah. Mr. Howell was good. I like Jim Bacchus, right?
Yes, Mr. Jim Bacchus. Also was, Mr. Magoo.
Yeah, he was great, great Mr. Magoo. I don't know why we're talking about this. I can't remember. Oh, why were we talking
Earworms.
About Earworms. Oh, yeah. So you're not going to sing the theme from Gilligan's Island and get it out?
Not at the moment.
Yeah. Gilligan's Island was one of those TV shows that did just the thing I was talking to you about at the break. You were talking about hypnosis, and there was a time at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s where every single sitcom that was on at some point had a hypnosis episode.
Yep.
And at some point had a quicksand episode.
And an amnesia episode.
That's right, the amnesia episode. And you were pointing out the way amnesia works is amazing.
One brain trauma causes amnesia. A second brain trauma cancels amnesia.
Right. Second time you get hit with that coconut on the head, Gilligan,
it all comes back to you. One shot stuns, two shots kills, and three shots disintegrates.
I know what that's a reference to, but the listener will have to look it up. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. No quicksand around here. No hypnosis. Just answers to your questions. Anonymous in Columbus, Ohio is listening on St. Gabriel Radio. Anonymous, you're on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi. Good day to you all.
You too. Thank you.
The question is, did God create other gods?
Okay. The answer is no. And that's something that is indicated in the book of Isaiah. At one point in Isaiah, God declares, I am the Lord, there is none but me, there were no gods formed before me, neither shall there be any gods formed after me. So he indicates he's the one and only God, and there are not going to be any subsequent gods, and consequently he didn't make any subsequent gods. That's something you can also infer just by principles of reason, because God, by definition, is an infinite, uncreated being. And if something's an infinite, uncreated being, then it can't be created. And so God could not create an uncreated being because that involves a logical contradiction. And so it's beyond the power of omnipotence. It's not really a thing. It's just verbal gibberish like a four-sided triangle or a married bachelor. You can't have a created, uncreated being. And so, God didn't make any other gods, provided we're referring to beings that are equal to him and that share his nature as an uncreated being. If you change the definition of the word God so that it refers to something less than the infinite, all-holy, uncreated creator, then you could talk about God creating other finite, quote-unquote, gods. And in fact, you will find language like that in various places in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And you'll find it, for example, in reference to angels who are sometimes referred to as sons of God, and they're obviously created beings. At times, the term gods is even used in the Old Testament. Jesus himself pointed this out in a conversation with some of his opponents, that there's one of the Psalms that says, you are gods, and it's talking to human rulers. And Jesus points out that the Psalms actually use the word God that way. And then the church fathers pick up that theme based on some passages in the New Testament where Peter, for example, talks about how through God's grace, we become partakers of the divine nature. So we have a share of God's life in us. We acquire a share of his holiness and things like that. The church fathers pick up on that and talk about us being made like God, or even they'll sometimes use the language, make us gods with a little g in English. And that process is known in theology as theosis, which would be the Greek term meaning to be made a god. But it's not the same kind of God as God himself is. It's a lesser finite thing.
Okay. Does that work for you, Anonymous?
Okay. So with just quickly, so like in Psalms when they mention about not having any other gods, our God is greater than all the other gods.
Mm-hmm.
Are they speaking of these finite gods that you're suggesting?
Those passages have been taken in different ways. Some people have said, okay, the Israelites came out of a pagan culture. I mean, originally Abraham's forefathers worshipped idols, and even the Israelites continued, like when they were in Egypt and during the Exodus, to worship idols, and it took a long time to wean them off of that. And so some people look at those passages and say that Israel as a group passed through a stage where they hadn't yet really realized that there are no other gods, but they had been given the revelation, you are only to worship Yahweh. And so Yahweh is the only one you're supposed to worship, but not everybody was clear yet on the fact, oh, and there aren't any others. Another way that those passages are sometimes taken is figuratively, meaning our God, Yahweh, he's the only one that exists, and the other so-called gods don't really exist. And that's more along the lines of something we see in St. Paul, where when he's talking about in the Roman world, there are many so-called gods, but for us, there is one God. And he means there are many idols, there are many fake gods. He later elsewhere says an idol is nothing. But really, that's just a popular perception that there are all these other gods, but really, we know there's just one.
Anonymous, thank you for those fine questions. Appreciate it. It is open forum today, and we go now to Nick in Pittsburgh. Nick, you're up with Jimmy Akin. Nick, have we got you there with us?
Hello?
Hi, Nick.
Hello?
Your question for Jimmy, Nick?
Okay. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a question. I know in the Council of Trent, it says that whenever you're confessing your sins, you have to confess the number and the name of the sin. But say you don't know the number. In my experience, the priest has always just said, just say the sin then, or sometimes I'll say I don't know, or I'll estimate, or I'll take a guess if I literally have no clue.
Uh-huh.
But I believe it's a mortal sin. Is confession still valid at that point?
Yes.
Or is there any impediment to that?
No, the reason it's valid is you're not deliberately holding anything back. It's understood that we're not going to remember every sin. And consequently, we're not obliged to confess the number or even the sin itself if we don't remember it. What we're responsible for doing is just the best we can. So if you're able to give an exact number, well, then you need to do that. But if you don't know the exact number and you can do a reasonable estimate, well, then give an estimate. If you can't even do that, just say, I know I did this, but I can't really put a number on it. And all that's fine because it's not like God's not going to forgive you if you forgot something and can't remember it. You're doing your part. You want to be reconciled with God. You're signifying that. You're wanting to do what you're supposed to, and you're not deliberately holding anything back. And so as long as you're not deliberately holding something back that you know you should confess, God's going to forgive you anyway.
Does that help, Nick?
Okay. Yeah. Can I have a short follow-up?
Sure.
Okay. So I also have little bit of scrupulosity, so I struggle with this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going through my day and I find something that might be, say, gossip, and I think, oh, that might be a mortal sin, by the end of the day, I might not remember all the circumstances surrounding that. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the week, I'm like, I have no idea if any of these things were mortal sins, so mm-hmm. I go to confession anyway. Whenever you're unsure, say, at the end of the day and you're examining your conscience, what is the best way to make a judgment on that when you don't remember all the circumstances?
There are two pieces of advice I would give you. The first one, gossip is almost never a mortal sin. In order for gossip to constitute a mortal sin, not only would you have to engage in it knowingly and deliberately in the moment, saying, I'm turning my back on God. This is just such juicy gossip. I'm willing to be damned over it, which you're probably not doing. But you would also, in addition to that, need to damage somebody's reputation in a grave way by the gossip. And usually that's not the case. Usually gossip is like, oh, did you hear this jerky thing so-and-so did?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you damaged his reputation a little bit, but not gravely. So gossip is very rarely a mortal sin. And so I wouldn't worry about that. The second piece of advice I would give you is a standard one that moral and pastoral theologians recommend for the scrupulous. If you're scrupulous, if you have tendencies in that direction, do not confess a sin unless you are certain that it is a mortal sin. Otherwise, the scrupulosity can exploit the situation and try to trap you in an agonizing cycle of doubt and confession. And you need to just put that aside and resist the temptations that scrupulosity presents you with to wallow in doubt and anxiety.
Nick, that's a pretty clear answer. I do hope that's helpful for you. We have to take a quick break. So we'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. Sayings like these are such a part of tradition that we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers, even though nobody can seem to place their origin. By sheer repetition, they have acquired a halo of truth. In What the Saints Never Said, Trent Horn takes over 40 of these well-known but actual dubious sayings and attempts to track them to their true source. The result? He finds some that are close to what was really said, many that were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few that were just plain made up. By setting the record straight, Trent roots out theological errors that can lead us away from Christian truth and offers authentic quotes from Scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to that truth. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said today by calling 1-888-291-8000. Visiting the shop at Catholic.com or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're coming down the home stretch here, so I will go as quickly as I can through these questions and not delay. Let's start with Clay in Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Clay, thank you so much for downloading the Catholic Answers app on your phone. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Well, I thank my mother-in-law. She put it on my phone for me. So
she, I Jimmy, always liked her.
Yeah, I've never heard of you before, Jimmy, but I am very impressed with your breadth of knowledge and your clear answers. You don't always get that with Christian apologists.
Well, thank you. You're very kind.
Well, I just wanted to ask a quick question. It's more slash comment question, because I don't know if there's a good answer or any answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's inspired by the lady earlier who said she's going to marry a guy who's Baptist or was raised Baptist. My wife is a devout Catholic. I'm not Catholic. I was raised Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of know what her family's probably going through, or you know what I mean, the situation there. So my biggest fear is it's a big fear. So whenever my kids get old enough to realize dad's not taking communion,
mm-hmm.
and might want to start asking questions as to why that is,
mm-hmm.
I don't really want to raise, you know what I mean? Like, if my wife wants to raise our kids Catholic, I mean, that's great. You know what I mean? I mean, that's whatever, you know, that's what she's mm-hmm. going to do either way. So
mm-hmm.
I just, you know, how do I answer my kids if that day comes, you know, which
Okay.
I don't know if it's...
Yeah. Well, so one can go into this subject in a lot of detail, but you probably don't want to do that when they're right at that age. And I don't know that it. I don't know that it'll ever get to the point where they really need a lot of detail. But if you do, you know, call us back and we'll point you to some resources. But in terms of a simple answer for children who are of that age, I would simply say I'm not Catholic, and it's important to take communion in your own church. And so, since you're a Catholic, you take communion here, and since I'm not a Catholic, I don't take communion here. And that's really all you need to say. And that's the truthful answer, is that it's important. Eucharistic communion is a sign of Christian unity. And so if we're not fully united, then we shouldn't be sharing this sign of unity. Now, that's something I wouldn't go into with them. I'd simply say it's important to take communion in your own church. And so that's why, and since I'm not Catholic, that's why I don't take communion in the Catholic Church. However, I would also mention, now I have a lot of sympathy for your situation because I used to, in fact, be Protestant. I'd been associated with different groups in the Protestant community, including Baptist and Church of Christ and Presbyterian during various phases of my upbringing. But when I got married, I was an evangelical, and I married a woman who very quickly after we got married went back to being Catholic. And that really threw a wrench in my career plans because I had been planning on becoming a Protestant pastor or seminary professor. And so I ended up having to say, well, I guess I'm not going to do that. I guess I'll – not with a Catholic wife, not in an evangelical context. I guess I will just go be a philosophy professor. And so I started studying for that. And then one day I made a discovery while I was reading some text from the Gospel of Matthew, and I realized that even though I had arguments to the contrary – there were features in Matthew 16 that required Peter to be the rock that Jesus is talking about when he says, "On this, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." It was plain as day as soon as I saw these features. I even talk about it on my website. If you go to jimmyakin.com and look up my conversion story or look up a paper in the library there called Why Be Catholic and Exercise for Evangelicals, I talk about those features in the text. And I realized all in a flash, well, if Peter's the rock on which Jesus built the church, that's a pretty good description of the office of the Pope. And if Catholics were right about this, then there might have been other later popes as part of Jesus's plan. And I need to look at all these areas in theology with an open mind. And I did. I took a year and reviewed all of the different areas of theology with an open mind, and I ended up concluding the Catholic Church was right. And so I ended up becoming a Catholic, which then allowed me to – even though this wasn't why I was studying it, it in fact allowed me to be united in the same faith with my wife, and it allowed us to receive communion together. And so I would suggest maybe, you know, take a look at some of these issues, and we've got a lot of resources that could help out. In fact, if I recently wrote a book called A Daily Defense, where I go through very brief, like one page chapters, one for each day of the year, and a lot of what's in the book is of interest to people just coming from a Christian background. Some of it's specifically Catholic, some of it's not. But if you'd like, I'd be happy to have a copy sent to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sure. I would like that a lot.
Okay.
Probably a lot further back than you as far as on a different path maybe. But I do agree with what you're saying as far as the rock. I mean, I don't even know why we talk about it. Like,
yeah.
I mean, as far as history goes, like I don't even know why that's even a discussion with other people. Just maybe don't want to admit that's what it meant. But
that's
anyhow,
a key reason. Okay, well, let's put you on hold, and we'll get your mailing address and see about getting you a copy of A Daily Defense.
Thanks so much, Clay. And remember, you're always welcome to call here, and we do open forums almost guaranteed twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays. I wanted to ask you something came to my mind when Clay was talking, and I wanted to ask you if you'd seen any of these the research on how important a father's practice of the faith is to children. Then,
well, I haven't looked at the studies in detail, but I've certainly seen accounts of it being important. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just thought, Clay's question made me think that we got to remind men it's very important if you want your children to have a church. Go to a church. Let's go to Paul now in Pennsylvania. Paul, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Yes, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering why the Greek word epiousios is translated as daily when Jerome translated it as, I think, supersubstantianum. I probably pronounced that incorrectly.
No, it's okay.
But, you know, I could see where Protestants might, you know, translate it as daily. But why Catholic Bibles?
Okay, so what you're talking about is a word that appears in the Lord's Prayer in Greek in Matthew and Luke. This word, I was recently writing about this, this word is notoriously hard to translate. And the reason for that is it appears in Greek literature for the first time right here in the Gospels. There are no precedents for this term, and it's such an unusual term that the second and third century Greek scholar Origen, who was one of the pioneers of biblical scholarship, he said nobody uses this word. I mean, educated Greek speakers don't use this word. Common Greek speakers don't use this word. He proposed that the evangelists coined it, and so that makes it really hard to figure out what Jesus would have said in Aramaic, because this is just a really unusual term. And there are bunches of suggestions. This is one of the classic problems in commentaries on on Matthew and on Luke. Now, when Jerome did a Latin translation of the Greek text, he didn't really know what to make of it either, and so he brought the two parts of it across into Latin literally. The word being epiousios, epi means on or upon, and so he translated that with the Latin super, which means above.
Uh-huh.
And ousios can, among other things, be translated substance. And so he brought that over into Latin, and between super for epi and substance and actually that's not inflected right, but that's the root that he used for ousios, he got supersubstantialiter. And so that then gets brought into older English translations like the Douay Rheims as supersubstantial. But in terms of what it means, that's really hard because this is just a coinage based on bringing the word over from its roots in Greek into Latin. It wasn't a pre-existing Latin word either. Mm-hmm. And so there have been a bunch of suggestions about what it means. Daily is one of them, and that's the word that's been passed down in standard English versions of the Lord's Prayer. Scholars propose other things, like maybe it means today, give us our bread for today. Some have suggested it means for tomorrow, give us our bread for tomorrow today. And there are other possibilities as well, but it's just a really hard word to translate. And that's even talked about in the Catechism of the Catholic Church if you look up the section on the Lord's Prayer.
Okay, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to use this as an apologetic tool to get people to think as a pointer toward the Eucharist. And maybe I'm putting too much into that. I guess that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, because of the way supersubstantial sounds, there have indeed been Catholics who have taken it as some kind of reference to the transubstantiation or the real presence, just because the word substance is in there. But in apologetic discussions, I wouldn't go that way. There's a saying in legal circles, hard cases make bad law, and there's a parallel in apologetics, I think. Hard verses make bad apologetics, because if it's unclear what a verse means, it's not arguments based on an unclear verse are not going to be that convincing to people who hold another point of view.
And there are quite a few passages in the Gospels that will point you towards the Eucharist, Paul.
And that are stronger and more clear.
Okay.
Wow, that was helpful because I was planning on using that. So thank you very much.
No problem.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Paul. That's fascinating. The first time it ever appears, it appears in the gospel.
Yeah.
There's quite a few words like that in Shakespeare in English.
Yes.
The first time we ever see him,
yeah,
Shakespeare using them.
He was such a lonely guy.
He was.
Well, he's the guy who invented the word lonely.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's where that came from.
Yeah, that's, isn't that something? The first time it appears, it's in the Gospels, yeah. And we don't know for sure what it means.
Yeah, personally, I doubt it was, it could have been Luke or Matthew, but it all who came up with it, but it also could have been someone who translated the Lord's Prayer into Greek before them.
Oh, yeah, and then they were, right.
And then they used it.
Tomorrow, please join us for the exciting introduction of our brand new game show. The title of the game show is the As Yet Untitled Catholic Answers Game Show. Carlo Broussard will be here first hour. We'll do regular apologetics first hour. Second hour, Carlo will be our celebrity guest, even though he doesn't like me calling him that, for the brand new game show. See you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.